Hello and welcome everybody to Podcasting Them Softly. I'm Frank, and of course I am joined with my co-host and my BFF, Nick. Hi, Nick.
What's going on, buddy? How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing very well.
This should be a fun
today.
Should be a
yeah.
Fun
this is going to be awesome because I got to do the introduction for a podcast again. So, you know, I think I'm like 5 to your 20. Actually, I think we've had more than that. But anyway, what makes this so awesome is we are joined with Melissa.
Should I just say it for you?
Yeah, just say it for me.
Melissa Mertz. It's hard to say my last name. It's no problem.
Awesome. We're joined with Melissa Mertz. I think I nailed it that
Perfect.
Time. Who is a television critic for Entertainment Weekly. She is also the host of Women on Pop, which is on Sirius XM, and she formerly worked for Vulture, Rolling Stone, and the LA Times.
Yep.
So we are way out of our league with this podcast, but Nick and I are going to try and hold the fort down while we discuss with you about the new television shows and what Nick and I like to call the new golden age of television.
That sounds awesome. I'm honored to be here with you guys.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I want to give a quick shout out to Matthew Wilder, who is a monthly contributor to our podcast, and he's the one that set us up with you. So thanks, Matthew.
Great guy, too.
Yeah, he's awesome. Totally great. So, yeah, I'm not even sure where to begin because, like we were talking about earlier, when somebody asks you what you're watching on television right now, there's just way too much for you to even give a short answer to.
Yeah, you know, people are complaining lately about this idea of peak TV, that there's so many shows on right now that it's impossible to keep up and impossible to have real, like, water cooler conversations. But I just feel like I can't possibly understand why people complain about that, because how can you complain about having so many options of so many good shows? You don't have to watch them all. I don't understand the complaints.
I think some of it might be is just that I agree with you. There should be no complaining. There's a ton of stuff out there. And in this day and age with all the various options that people have to watch things, you know, you could certainly pick out of a hat and find something that you're likely interested in. I think that honestly, because this is for me, there's so much that I want to see. And I feel like I need another 3 hours in the day to get in the shows that I'm not watching, that I'm just sort of like not depressed about it, but I'm just sort of bummed that, you know, while I'm watching 5 or 6 great shows, there's another 5 or 6 that just have gone unwatched. And, you know, I just don't know if I'll have time for them.
See, I feel the exact opposite. I feel like knowing that I have all of these shows that I haven't watched yet actually makes me feel excited, because when I get to the end of a show that would normally make me feel really sad that it's over because I loved it so much, then there's always going to be something else out there that I haven't discovered yet that's going to make me really excited. So I guess I see that stress in kind of a positive way, but maybe that's just because I'm a TV critic.
No, certainly. It's I feel like I'm somewhere in between the two of you, because I know Nick has watched more of the more high-profile shows that are out now than I have. I hate to even admit this, but I haven't seen the first season of Fargo, and I haven't seen the second season at all yet, either. I feel like I'm getting so far behind on everything because I'm so focused on the HBO shows, and of course, there's so many movies that are coming out at the same time, so it's hard to to keep up with everything. And then with social media, I mean, it just gets blown for you, a lot of things, I think, in shows. I know a lot of people that Nick and I are friends with that either live overseas or weren't watching it live. I would make all sorts of True Detective posts because I was overly obsessed. I was in the one percentile of viewers that were overly obsessed with the second season of True Detective, and I was posting about it all the time. So I kind of have to, like, stray from that as well.
Well, I will say, a controversial opinion, but I think the current season of Fargo is better than anything on HBO this year. So I would say you don't have to catch up with the first season if you don't want to. The second season stands on its own, but definitely watch that when you can.
Now I'm
right, because it's my impression that, sorry, I'll let you speak here in a sec.
Of course. Yeah.
It's a prequel, but it's also a standalone where Patrick Wilson is playing the Keith Carradine character, correct?
Mm-hmm.
From the first one. I mean, I saw an ad where Bruce Campbell's playing Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
In the series, so I was just completely sold.
Yes.
I thought that was like the greatest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
The casting is just insanely good.
That's awesome. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Nick.
Yeah, no, I thought the first season of Fargo was glorious, and I've got to watch the first episode, and I've got the second episode to watch on the DVR still, so I haven't seen episode two, and unlike the critics, we're not sent three or four or however many you guys get sent at a time, which is always, you know, very nice. So I can't wait to see where season two goes based on the first episode. I don't want to spoil anything for Frank. He hasn't seen it yet. But there was a really, really clever Coen Brothers reference thrown in there that I don't know if it's just a Coen Brothers reference or not. Or if it's something that's going to play out later in the season, but, I think Fargo is one of the great American crime films, and I was hesitant to even consider this show as an option when I first heard about it. I was like, oh my God, they're really going to make a TV show out of Fargo? I mean, come on. Like, why? And then when I saw the show, I was like, damn, like these people figured it out. They didn't try to recreate what was so brilliant about the movie. They did exactly what you should do if you're going to sort of, you know, update something for a different medium. I just thought it was absolutely brilliant. And one of the things that I was so obsessed with was that Fargo, the television show, works for the viewer who's never seen Fargo, the movie, but for the people who are totally obsessed, and I'm talking Fargo was the movie where, like, you know, I skipped school to go see it with my buddies. Like, I saw that movie like five times in the theater. It completely captured me. So when that moment, I won't say what it is for Frank, but when that moment happens midway through season one, where Fargo, the TV show, bridges with Fargo, the movie, in a way that the true fans of the movie would know, I fell off the couch.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that you can really geek out deeply on the Coen Brothers references and like the inside jokes, but you don't need them because it does feel like a very original creation to me. And it also feels like, I mean, the Coen Brothers are obviously from the Midwest. Noah Hawley, the creator of the TV version of Fargo, is not, but I feel like he gets so many things about the Midwest right. Like there's a line, I don't think this spoils anything, but there's a line in an upcoming episode where a character basically says, like, people think that Minnesota nice is politeness, but really it's you acting like I'm doing you a favor by being polite to you. And I think that that really is so true about the way that people are nice to each other in the Midwest.
I haven't seen it, and I completely agree because I'm from the Midwest.
Yeah, I lived there for 5 years, so.
I feel that for sure. But, yeah, Fargo is one of those shows that makes me excited to watch, and knowing that I have a full first season and then two episodes of the new season. So I may do that this weekend and take a sabbatical from constant film watching. The one thing I will say is it makes me excited because I thought FX – was off to a really hot start when they first started with original dramatic programming. I loved Damages. I thought that was one of the best series that I had ever seen. Not so much like the DirecTV exclusive last season, or I don't know if it was two seasons, but the first couple seasons I was completely blown away by. I was blown away by The Shield as well.
The Shield was my crack rock when I lived in Los Angeles. That show still stands for me as like the ultimate television cop show. I mean, it's like there's been so many great procedurals and cop dramas, but The Shield is just a major wow.
And you look at the stuff that they have now. I mean, I feel like so many of my favorite shows are on FX, like The Americans and Louie and Fargo and even something small like You're the Worst, which I love. I just feel like they're really doing a lot of interesting stuff right now.
Totally agree.
I agree too, because I never got into Sons of Anarchy. I tried watching it a couple times and I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just like, I feel like I'm the only person in the world that never got into that show. I mean, I remember I watched a couple of episodes that Peter Weller was in towards the end because I'm a huge Peter Weller fan, but yeah, that was just a show that never really clicked with me, I guess.
I feel like that's a show that I liked thinking about more than I liked actually watching.
It's a punishing show.
Yeah.
I was resistant to it. Two seasons went by. So like the start of the third season, I had finally heard enough from my sister and from a really good friend of mine. They were just for 2 years, they were just like, Nick, what is wrong with you? Like, why aren't you watching Sons of Anarchy? And I was like, I don't want to watch a show about motorcycle gangs. Like, it's not my thing. I don't care. I don't want to see it. And I just said, fine, you know what? If they're going to continuously beat me down on this, I'll give it a shot. And I got completely obsessed and hooked. And it's no more a show about bikers than, you know, Friday Night Lights was about football. And I bring that as an example because Friday Night Lights was, for me, one of, like, the best TV shows ever. I loved every moment of that television show. But Sons of Anarchy is, like, high melodrama, soap opera, Shakespeare, and tons of graphic violence. And it's like, I can't believe what that show gets away with or got away with. And in general, I'm really blown away by what is able to be shown on FX, like in terms of the graphic content. It's amazing.
Do you feel like there's a moment for you when you kind of switch off? Because with Sons of Anarchy, for me, it would get more and more violent, and I was kind of with it. And then there was a certain point where it's like you're cutting off an ear and you're cutting off a nose, and it's just like diminishing returns. Like, I feel like it got less shocking over time.
Yes, when you've seen somebody, when you've seen every type of maiming that there is to offer, there does sort of become a repetitious quality, which is one of the reasons why, you know, just we're show hopping, which is fun. One of the reasons why I stopped watching something like The Walking Dead is because it was just the same damn thing every single time that I put on an episode. Shoot zombies in the face, run away, talk about it. Have a heart to heart. This person's, you know, having a bad day. Shoot zombies in the head for 20 minutes. I'm just like, okay, enough.
Yeah.
Well, glad that we went under The Walking Dead, because I mean, like, I'm,
and both Frank and I have no use for it.
I'm with Nick to a certain degree on that show. Like, I watched the pilot and I thought the pilot was great. I was really excited for this, and I was with most of the first season, and then the second season was like half good for me anyway, and then third season came along, and I was so happy that Michael Rooker finally came back.
Yeah.
I love him as an actor, and I thought his character was great, but I just completely switched off to The Walking Dead. I don't even know if it was like the fourth season or the fifth season. I'm not even up to date. I don't even know how many seasons there are of the show, like six or seven.
And now there's a spinoff.
Yeah.
And the spinoff I tried to watch because I was, you know, I thought it would be genius if somehow they took all the faults, maybe, I don't know, I guess the faults that I saw in The Walking Dead, and they made Fear the Walking Dead like this great show on the same caliber as AMC has done with Mad Men and Breaking Bad, and then more specifically Better Call Saul. Mm-hmm. I mean, geez, I can't think of a more of a gold standard for a quote-unquote spinoff show.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about Better Call Saul because that's,
let's talk about Better Call Saul
of the year. And I know that both of you love it. So what do you two love about it?
I was so worried. I loved Breaking Bad. I think Breaking Bad's like one of the best shows I've ever seen. It was so taut. There was no filler. All the characters were so well fleshed out to where they could get their own series and it would just be amazing. And I love the way the show ended. I really have like zero complaints to Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And then it concluded, and then they were talking about a spinoff with Better Call Saul. And originally, I believed it was supposed to be like a 30-minute comedy.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how it was going to work. I think Bob Odenkirk's a genius. I loved his character, but I thought his character was so great because you got small doses of him.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't going to be a full show, but essentially what happened was I didn't have cable, and I just had the internet, and I streamed everything. I specifically got cable for the last season of Mad Men, and then even more so for Better Call Saul, because I had this feeling it was going to be great. And I mean, I was completely blown away by the first season of that show. I couldn't even believe how great it was. And I mean, it was just from the pilot. I believe there was the All That Jazz reference to the film.
Yeah.
And the pilot of that show. And I was just like, oh my God, I felt like the show was made specifically for me. I couldn't believe how dramatic it was.
Well, I loved it too. And I think, you know, Breaking Bad is my all-time favorite show. So I went into this feeling like it's probably not going to be as good. You know, my expectations were pretty low. But the thing I love about Breaking Bad that I also love about Better Call Saul is that they're both pretty moral shows despite all the crazy, like, haphazard killing and violence.
Right.
And I think Breaking Bad is about a guy who convinces himself that he's a good guy who has to do something bad, even though it becomes pretty clear to us over time that he's kind of a bad guy who wants an excuse to do bad things. And Better Call Saul is different for me because it's about a guy who really is somewhere deep down genuinely good, but circumstances kind of keep preventing him from making the decisions a good man would make. So he has no choice but to keep kind of slipping in to these bad behaviors that he's just so good at. And I think it's so fascinating and kind of heartbreaking to see that happen to him, because you know he could be this great moral, like, upstanding lawyer, but he just can't seem to do it.
Yeah, you said it exactly. It's heartbreaking because you constantly see him realizing that he'll succeed and go further if he bends the law and does something crooked and shady. And yeah, it's working against his inner being. Like, you're right, like, he and you and obviously how they presented the character now in this prequel, which is just very in general, it was just a very tricky, very ballsy thing, for lack of a phrase. Like, it really was, to take a show that everybody was so hot on and in love with so much and got huge ratings and the critical support and Emmys, and then you announce you're going to do a spinoff and it's not going to be in the same tone. And we're going to take one of the, like Frank said, we're going to take one of the best colorful,
like, novelty characters,
a novelty character,
yeah,
supporting character with a great color and great, you know, dramatic, you know, great potential. But I don't think anyone expected the show to be as rich as it would be dramatically. The relationship with Michael McKean and, yeah, and Bob Kirk is just fantastic. And, you know, it walked that really fine line of having to appease people who were expecting Breaking Bad 2.0 and those of us who knew that would never be like that. And, you know, I think it really comes down to the genius of Gilligan and all of his, you know, cohorts and them really knowing that world and the characters. And the Saul character is tragic because, again, like, he's constantly reminded and he constantly sees that by doing the wrong thing, he ends up succeeding, which, you know, like, you know, what lawyer doesn't know about that?
Well, and also it's like, you can't really decide whether to feel sorry for him or admire him. Like, I think about, like, the scene, I love his relationship with Kim, who's, you know, they've kind of had this past together, and it seems like he kind of wants to get back into it. She's not so sure. But I love the scene when she goes to visit him in his office, and it's also this nail salon, and he paints her toenails, because there's so many ways you can read that scene. Like, on one hand, it seems so pathetic. It's like he's trying anything he can to get back together with her. On another hand, it just feels really sweet, like he's doing this thing that is just so nice for this woman who is super stressed out and trying to help him. But then you also think about it and you're like, that's also really savvy. Like, he works inside a nail salon, he has free access to all this stuff, so why not take advantage of it? So, like, I love that it works on all of those levels.
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, I completely agree with what you guys are saying. It's amazing watching this transformation of Jimmy McGill because we see this origin of him and we know exactly who he becomes. So, you know, episode by episode, we're seeing the genesis of Saul Goodman come out of him through the different situations that he gets put in. I mean, I love how the show opened with that black and white bookend to the end of the show, Breaking Bad. Like, this is where he ends up, as a manager of a Cinnabon with a mustache.
Yeah. Well, it's a callback to something in Breaking Bad where he says, you know, I'm going to end up food counter or something like that. And
right.
There he is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's great. And, I mean, not to mention, I have always loved Jonathan Banks. Like, back to the TV show Wise Guy from the 80s,
yeah.
I've always thought Jonathan Banks is a fantastic character actor. And I was skeptical of him being involved in it. It's like, how are they just going to build all of this together and make it flush with where Mike and Saul enter into the show Breaking Bad? But more specifically with Jonathan Banks, Mike is the one standalone episode we get where it's his backstory, where they don't even – Jonathan Banks and that character of Mike is so perfectly put together that we don't even need that story, because I think that his character and I think that Jonathan Banks' performance in that character kind of – we already know essentially where he's come from in life. Like, we know he's this hard guy that went through a lot of stuff, and now he ended up here, and he's the ultimate pro. But, I mean, that episode – that might be my favorite episode of – Better Call Saul was his backstory. I just couldn't even believe how fantastic that episode was.
Yeah, and what's crazy about that episode, I think you're talking about 5-0, is that
right.
It was written by somebody who was a writer's assistant on Breaking Bad. Like, I like that Vince Gilligan really gives people a shot, you know, that it's like, it's not just his show. It's also Peter Gould. It's also Michelle McLaren, who did a lot of stuff on Breaking Bad. It's like really a team thing. And also that you can have something like 5-0, which just feels like a crime thriller on its own. But the show is also kind of a workplace comedy when you get to the law office. And it's also a really great drama about sibling rivalry. It's just all of these different types of shows that somehow work together.
Yeah, you know, and I do love how there are those little Easter eggs to Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
Like how Tuku shows up in, was it the first episode? Yeah, the end of the first episode. And it'll be very interesting to see if they bring Walter White and Jesse and Gus and all these other characters that should have some sort of weave through this story, because I'm under the impression that this show is supposed to be not only a prequel, but a parallel and then a sequel to Breaking Bad.
Oh, I didn't realize that. A sequel?
Yeah, or maybe not a sequel, but...
because it starts at the end. I guess that's true.
Because, it starts at the end, but I'm under the impression from what I've read of Gilligan talking about the show is this show's supposed to start before and then run along the same lines as Breaking Bad. And then end after...
I had read that, too. Like, at a certain...
What happened to Walter.
Yeah, like, at a certain point, the narrative in Better Call Saul might be paralleling the action of Breaking Bad. I think I did read that as well. Hopefully that occurs.
How do you feel about that? Like, when do you want that to happen?
I think that's an amazing idea. I think
it's
kind of like in the Bourne movies where the Bourne Legacy, the first 10 minutes of that movie is happening concurrently with the action of the Bourne Ultimatum, which I like completely flipped out about just to make sort of a structural reference. But yeah, if you would be able, if they're able to do that and, maybe not necessarily visually reference the Breaking Bad episode or the events of that, you know, I think that could be really neat.
I think it's audaciously brilliant in a way, if they're able to pull it off. And I mean, if the first season's an indication of what they have in store for the next couple seasons or however long the show's run is, I think it could work out well, because I mean, we're probably going to get Bryan Cranston and what's his name?
Aaron
Paul in it. You know, they'll do cameos. I would imagine they there's no way they wouldn't, I think. But I also find it very interesting and intriguing to see the other side of the Breaking Bad story, where Saul is scrambling with Mike to try and figure out and fix what's going on when the bad times start to happen in Breaking Bad. I mean, I do want to see more of Gus Fring, because I thought that that character was fantastic in Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
me too. Yeah.
And also, I had read an interview with Robert Forster around the when Better Call Saul was first coming out. I forgot. I don't know if it was an AV Club interview or it was something with him. And he said he'd been contacted by the showrunners of Better Call Saul to reprise his role.
Oh, that's great.
And I think that would be fantastic, because I think we'd be able to see more of him.
That was
because,
so amazing. I mean,
and how fantastic was it that they cast? I almost jumped out of my seat when Robert Forster showed up.
And like you have this show, right? Like Breaking Bad is crescendoing, right? And you're waiting for everyone's comeuppance and catharsis, and like you're just like everything's happening and it's exploding all around. And then Robert Forster comes in, and you don't know this guy. And he just owns every scene, and he paints this picture of a guy who you can kind of understand, and you get a sense of where he's been and what he's all about. If we get a chance to see that character, I mean, listen, I think Vince Gilligan is just one of, like, he's a genius. Like, his work throughout the years on a variety of shows, I mean, like, one of the masterminds of the X-Files. He did The Lone Gunman, which unfortunately didn't last very long. I love that show. It was so much fun.
I did too.
We can get into the X-Files next, probably, because, you know, Frank and I are big X-Files fans. We're excited for the reboot, and Lone Gunman's awesome. But I'm Gilligan, I mean, I remember when I was working out in L.A., I remember reading Vince Gilligan's version of Tonight He Comes, the movie which became Hancock. And I remember saying to myself, oh, my God, this needs to be a TV show. Like, they shouldn't even make this into a movie. This should be a miniseries about a down and dirty superhero. I think Gilligan's amazing. I trust him. Whatever he wants to try, I'm down for, you know, for the exploration with him. But since I brought up the X-Files, are you an X-Files fan?
You know, this is something that'll probably get me fired from Entertainment Weekly. But, you know, I never watched it when it was on. And now I know I have to catch up, because I'm a huge sci-fi fan. I love, like, twist endings. Like, I feel like everything about it is kind of in my wheelhouse. And I love Gillian Anderson right now in The Fall. So I feel like I've gotta do it before.
Show. I've been meaning to
watch.
And
David Duchovny.
Yeah, and David Duchovny. Yeah, of course.
Well, you just happen to be in luck, because they're all on Netflix and Amazon. I don't know if it's on Amazon Prime, but it's all on Netflix, and they just remastered it in HD and released it on HD. I'll tell you what, though, if you're going to do it, just, like, bypass the last three seasons and skip the second movie that they made,
okay.
Because the second movie they made is horrendous.
Yeah, it's bad.
And it really has no bearing to the overall storyline or anything. It's essentially a standalone movie. And, I mean, the last three seasons, David Duchovny's in most of 7. Or I should say he's at the beginning of 7, and then he leaves the show, and Robert Patrick essentially replaces him. But the last two seasons of that show, and the way they end the show, is just dreadful. And I'm so happy that they're bringing the show back. I thought the teaser looked great. So
yeah, a lot of people at the office were really excited about it. And we were just talking recently about the creepiest episodes ever made of television. And my co-TV critic, Jeff Jensen, mentioned the episode Home, which I have not seen, but everybody else in the office lost their minds about how good and how scary they thought that episode was.
I believe it's the first episode of season 4 that they didn't air on television live. When the show was in its initial. Oh, it's grotesque.
Grotesque.
It's just, I can't even believe, I totally understand why it wasn't on TV. It's just, I mean, now it's probably no big deal, you know, with all the graphic nature of violence and everything else that's on television now. But, I mean, that episode is frightening.
And, Melissa, I'll say this, if, you know, we know how much you watch and how much you have to watch for your job and obviously for pleasure and everything else. If you don't have enough time and you do want a crash course on the X-Files, you can watch the alien-centric episodes. You know how there was the overarching conspiracy? You know, like, the X-Files operated on, like, two wavelengths. You had all of the you know, the alien, you know, mythology episodes, which would come every third or fourth episode, right? You'd get an alien episode, then you'd get, you know, the boogeyman, the werewolf, you know, this monster, that thing. Then you'd come back to the, you know, the central story, you know, Mulder's sister being supposedly taken by aliens when he's a young kid, and, you know, the parents, you know, the background. It's fantastic. I believe that Fox has put out at one point a DVD set of simply the alien episodes.
Oh, so that's great.
You could watch the core stuff, because from what I gather, the six episodes on the reboot, what is it, the first two are alien centric or overarching mythology, and then the middle four are sort of standalones. Is that what I've been led? That's what I've been led to believe.
Yeah.
All I know is they're doing six episodes, and I can't imagine they're not going to do more.
Well, there's Halloween, catching up on X-Files alien episodes.
yeah, that's
perfect.
You know, because what was that, Frank? But that's got to be like, 30 episodes probably of the show comprise the alien mythology?
I would imagine it's a little bit more, because what, that was back in the day when the seasons were like 20-some episodes long, when television shows did that.
I mean, like, just thinking about it right now, I would love to sit down and watch all of the alien. The X-Files was family TV night back in the day when I was in high school. Like, I was obsessed with aliens and UFOs and government conspiracies when I was like 13, 14, 15. So when a TV show came out that was all about that, it was like my dream come true. It really was.
Okay, so I have to ask you another question then, if that's true. Are you going to watch, or have you already watched, The Man in the High Castle, which is being developed by Frank Despoto from X-Files?
Yeah, I it's not on right now, correct? It's not, it hasn't aired.
The pilot is on, but the rest of the season, I think, is coming out in November, because I really love the pilot.
Where's the pilot? Is this like an Amazon show?
It is. It's an Amazon Prime show.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah. It's exactly what you said. It's like all the like conspiracy theory stuff is done so well.
Yeah, I definitely have interest. I believe, what, didn't Ridley Scott have something to do with that, too? I could be wrong.
Executive producer, yeah.
Yeah, I really do want to see that, definitely. It's I'm not familiar with the background, the source material, I don't really know too much about it. I've just heard about it. I've seen artwork, I've seen posters, and it's on my radar for sure.
So it's a Philip K. Dick book that inspired it, and the premise is like an alternate history, imagining that the Nazis and the Japanese won World War II and have split the U.S. into Nazi-occupied territory and Japanese-occupied territory. But there's also all of these conspiracies about, did the Allies actually win and they covered it up for some reason, and there are characters who you're not sure if they're working for or against the Allies, and it's just really like, it gets that paranoia that I've been told that the X-Files did really well in a really excellent way.
I can't even believe I haven't heard of this. This sounds like the greatest fucking thing I've ever heard of in my entire life.
It's really good, yeah.
Oh my God. God.
It really is. You know, getting back to the overall sort of comment we led off with, it's alarming between Amazon, Netflix, AMC, the pay channels, FX. I mean, we haven't even talked about any network shows. I mean, I'm not anywhere near as well versed in network shows that I used to be, because honestly, the stuff on cable and on the pay outlets, they just really started, for me, they just started to really outweigh the networks with the writing and with the production value and with the storytelling. And one of the things I think that's really interesting, and you know, I'm assuming that you watch The Nick, Melissa?
Yeah, I do. I love The Nick.
Yeah, okay. So I'm blown away with the whole single director coming into television, taking over the creative reins of a show, guiding something from, you know, from point A to point B to see the whole thing. And what went on with, you know, True Detective, especially season, you know, I like season two, definitely. Season one was obviously done by Fukunaga, the whole thing, the, you know, Hawley on Fargo. Did you watch The Missing on Stars? The Missing. Did you like it?
I did, but I feel like at a certain point with the, like, kids in danger, possibly killed dramas, I'd seen so many of them that I was like, I can't do this. I think I had just finished Broadchurch, and I thought, I can't watch another show about a possibly dead kid.
Yeah, well,
so well done.
Well-traveled terrain for sure, but that show, how they did that show with three timelines and never hand-holding the audience and making the audience work to look at the hairstyles and the makeup and the costumes and to determine what story was being told. I thought that show was absolutely just engrossing beyond belief. I couldn't. And then the ending came and it was like a gut punch. But I've been blown away about how television has sort of become this like mini movie central in a way. Like, you know, you're getting these really strong voices behind these shows, singular voices.
Yeah. Well, and you know, with the Nick, it's especially interesting because usually you think of like the person who's the auteur of the show, if you can even use that word in TV, as the person who's the showrunner. And I feel like that's the one show, the Nick, that I watch more for the way it's directed than what is actually going on in the plot. In fact, I can't even remember the names of the creators of that show because it feels so much like Soderbergh's show to me. It's like the music and the camera angles and the lighting and just like the physicality of those surgery scenes. For some sick reason, I love to see the way that surgery was done in like the turn of the 20th century and see them like, you know, saw into a body or something and the way that he films that. It's just filmed in such an amazing way that it's almost like I don't care as much what's happening with the characters.
Yeah, I'm completely ashamed to admit this, but I don't have Cinemax. I didn't get it as part of my package. Nick browbeat me into ordering the Blu-ray of the Nick. And I was like, okay, I'll get it. And I got it. And the week I got it, I watched the whole first season in that weekend. And I was completely obsessed with that show. I couldn't believe how good it was. And I completely agree with what you're saying. And I know Nick will agree too, that show is this amazing culmination of Soderbergh's aesthetic.
Yeah.
And style that, I mean, I couldn't stop watching the show, and I would almost find myself withdrawing from the actual storyline of what's happening in the episode and just watching it aesthetically because it was so amazing.
Well, you know what he does so well, I think, is that normally when you watch a period drama, it's almost kind of quaint and like the types of music that it chooses or the costumes or like some kind of joke about like a machine that now we take for granted. And one thing that he does so well is that he doesn't do that. He makes the past seem futuristic. Like the way that he uses electronic music.
The music is just, like
cutting edge technology. It makes you feel like you're watching the future, even though it's like 1901. And I love how he does that.
Oh yeah, Cliff Martinez's score is fantastic.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh my God, I can't even. That's one of the first things I said to Nick when I was watching the show. I said, "This score is out of this world."
Yeah.
And I mean, not to mention Clive Owen. I'm so glad Clive Owen has some sort of grandiose platform like the Nick to come back and show the world that he's this fantastic actor that's buried.
How tried making him into a movie star, and the guy, as much as I wanted him to be James Bond, not that I don't like Daniel Craig, but, you know, when he didn't get Bond, you know, he got all these roles for like 4 or 5 years, and audiences were like kind of cool to him, so whatever. But I've always loved the guy. You know, the BMW film series is one of the coolest goddamn things ever made, and like that was that was his audition for Bond. And this show is just – it's phenomenal from top to bottom. I'm a Soderbergh disciple. I think he's a genius. There's nothing that he's ever done that I haven't enjoyed on some level. And as Frank said, the aesthetics of the Nick are incredible. The handheld camera work on a period show is amazing. It's the furthest thing from Downton Abbey or any stuffy period piece or anything like that. I love the sort of the versatility of the camera work, how the camera is always tracking low on people, and it's something very unique about it. The whole sort of the stage setting, the proscenium that they're on doing their it's like they're auditioning for something, you know, out there doing those surgeries. And I think it's really cool. And It's just so fascinating to watch on a historical level. I've been able I do understand what you guys are saying about being floored by his style, especially because it's so unique in television. The storyline I have felt has just been thoroughly absorbing. Sometimes I sort of have to really pay attention to how people are talking because it's not – the show isn't written. And this is to the credit of the writers. I'm trying to remember. I think this was a Jack Amiel. I'm trying to remember the name Berger. I'm trying to remember the names of the guys who created the show. But I'm pretty sure they've written almost every episode, the creators.
Yeah, they have.
Or most of them. Yeah, they have. So it's really unique in the sense that and they're not holding your hand with that storytelling. I mean, there's nothing, you know, there's no easy in for the viewer. You have to work for that show. And that's what I've always been a fan with Soderbergh. He's a sly little, you know, he's a sly devil with his choices of storytelling. And, you know, some people always felt him to be too sort of like too smart for his own good, maybe, or too calculating. But I feel like here he's really found material that plays to his strengths.
Well, and what you're talking about with his camera angles, like, I love that most shows you're automatically kind of supposed to, if not sympathize with the characters, at least get inside their heads. And I feel like with his camera work, he makes a point of keeping like a clinical distance from the characters so that you're observing them almost like a scientist or something. You're like, you know, watching them kind of do these things and thinking, but they're really at arm's length. And I love that because you don't see that happening on a lot of shows.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you was I can't remember the last time I've been vested in a broadcast show.
Yeah.
I remember I was all excited for Aquarius because I love David Duchovny.
Yeah.
I think I probably watched like the first three episodes or four episodes and I kind of tuned out of it. And then I was excited for The Blind Spot because I'm a big fan of Mark Pellington's. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was just incredibly well directed, but it doesn't, and same for like the Blacklist. I was with the Blacklist for, I think, like the first season, but I just find myself tuning out of particularly broadcast shows that are episodic as opposed to having one ongoing storyline.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how you felt about that since...
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of my favorite shows are either cable or streaming. I think The Good Wife is still pretty good.
I want to watch that, yeah.
Yeah, like there's still some network shows I feel like are always pretty solid. I really was into the first season of Empire just because of how bananas it was, but now I'm not so sure. It just feels like it has diminishing returns. But I'm going to tell you something really embarrassing. You know what I think the most... exciting network show is and has been for a super long time is Survivor.
I have never watched one episode of that show.
You know, I was so snobby about it. When I first met my husband, he was really into it. And I was like, there's no way you're going to get me to watch that show. And I am so hooked on it. I think there is no smarter reality TV show. People bring so much strategy into it and so much kind of fan self-awareness where the people who are on it have watched all the previous seasons and have strategized based on the reactions of previous contestants in a way that I just find so fascinating. And anytime I say that, people are like, no way, Survivor. But seriously, if you start watching, you will be hooked.
Oh, yeah. So, listen, I worked in reality TV for 4 years. I worked at an agency and then I worked at a production company. So I definitely saw and this was when reality TV was like really booming, like when it was just getting really hot. And, you know, I worked for the people that did Extreme Makeover. You know, they packaged Extreme Makeover Home Edition. Remember that big one with Ty Penning?
Sure, yeah.
So The Survivor, The Amazing Race, you know, those shows certainly have always been inherently compelling on a human, on a base level. And now as the years have gone on and you've had 20 cycles of these shows, you're right. People must be, because I don't watch any reality TV really, except for a couple of, you know, guilty pleasures, which maybe we won't get into in this podcast, but the sense of, like you said, people watching season after season after season of stuff and then bringing in their strategy that they've learned, I can only imagine how the dynamics of a show like Survivor and Amazing Race and some of these long running ones. I don't know if the Amazing Race is on anymore, but how they've changed, how they must have morphed into something new.
And, you know, I think that's the problem with network TV generally, is that you have to do season after season after season. And a lot of those seasons are like 20 episodes long or something insane. Like, this, to be able to sustain a story for that long after every season is just exhausting, and it can't withstand it. And one thing that I love about cable is you have so many short form things. You have Sherlock, which is only 3 episodes, or you have Catastrophe on Amazon, which is only 6 episodes. And you have things that kind of are the length they're supposed to be. And I think that's a problem for network TV right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. That's why I love that the X-Files revival is coming back for 6 episodes.
Yeah, exactly what it needs to be, right?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what they do with that, because, I mean, like we were saying before, X-Files was 20-plus episodes a season, and, I mean, there was a lot of episodes that weren't really that great, but there was a lot that were fantastic. So it'll be interesting, because I believe that the X-Files was announced before Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of set a trend with, you know, X-Files came first, then Twin Peaks, then Full House. And then what? Gilmore Girls? I was reading is coming back to Netflix.
Yeah, Full House is
like I'm waiting for like Saved by the Bell or something like that to happen now, right?
Well, you know, it's because the first one of these I remember is Arrested Development, which people really hated, but I loved. I thought it was such a good revival, and I think people who return to it in years' time, I'm hoping, will see it for how good it was, because it wasn't just adding on to what I loved about Arrested Development. There were so many in-jokes and callbacks, and the way it was structured was kind of made for binge-watching it. I just thought it was really well done.
Arrested Development was a show that I missed when I missed the boat on it, and then I got into it briefly, and then for whatever reason, not for a lack of enjoyment, I just got busy and didn't continue with it. And I would honestly, with Arrested Development, I would have to watch it all from the very beginning. And I wish that is one of my blind spot shows, like, that I just know that I need to have sort of seen by now, and I haven't.
I don't even think you need to watch the whole thing. Like, you need to watch the whole thing in order to get every single inside joke. But I think there's some pretty great standalone episodes that you could just watch and think they're funny on a lighter level.
Okay. Because to me, that seems like a show where you would have to watch everything for the comedy or the characters to be born out of, you know, the situations to be born out of the characters. But
I think you do to totally appreciate it. But I think if you wanted to just, like, start by watching some standalone episodes, that it still would seem good to you.
Nice. All right. Well, again, that's always been one that I've always wanted to sort of catch. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, and now with Netflix and with Amazon and what Hulu now is going to be doing their own. I just saw a friend of mine just pulled my wife and I out of the Stone Ages and got us an Apple TV. So now, so now I'm completely screwed, because not that I didn't have enough to watch between regular DVRing, you know, through my HD cable and all the movies that, you know, Frank and I watch for our show and just for in general. Now I've got all the streaming capabilities, and I just don't even know where to begin. Like, it's just
so much too. Like, I feel like one of my favorite shows of the year was this show Difficult People that was on Hulu. That's Billy Eichner and Julie Klausner. And it's kind of like a Seinfeld style show about two friends in New York who are totally insufferable people. And that's on Hulu. Like, I feel like now Amazon Prime and Hulu and Netflix and all of these streaming sites, it used to just be Netflix. Now even the streaming sites, there's so many of them.
And I loved that you brought up You're the Worst on FX. It's really funny and bitter and unlike anything else that's on TV. And I'm also a huge fan of Married. I think that show is Married and Togetherness. Do you watch Married?
Yes, both of those shows I loved. And, you know, I feel like Married, a lot of people it kind of flew under their radar because there was so much attention paid to You're the Worst. But I think that show is really good.
It's so sweet and funny and perceptive. And I'm like, Frank knows, I've loved Judy Greer forever. I think she's wonderful. and finally a role where Judy Greer can sink her teeth into it instead of just being thankless, you know, friend or the girl, you know, the one that doesn't get the guy, you know, and which she can do in her sleep. But I think it's a great show. Nat Faxon's hysterical on it.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember the guy's name who plays, you know, their degenerate friend. His name escapes me. He's a pisser. Yeah, it's so funny. And Jenny Slate, I'm a huge fan. I love The Obvious Child. I think she's great. And it's just a really funny show. There's one show I want to bring up. Frank hasn't seen it yet, and I think he'll like it. And I'm wondering what you think. Is The Affair? Because I think The Affair is...
I've seen The Affair.
What?
Yeah.
I've seen it.
I thought you didn't see The Affair.
No, man, I've seen it.
Oh.
What do you think? Do you both of you like it?
I love it.
Yeah,
I thought it was a very cool way of telling a story, and then I thought it got kind of trying towards the end of it.
I can understand that.
But that's just me. I know the people love it.
I mean, I'm still really into it. I feel like I watch it with my husband, and maybe this is a vast overgeneralization, but I feel like a lot of the women I know immediately take the women's perspective side and be like, oh, that's the true side. And the guys are always like, oh, no, obviously the guy is telling the truth. And even that, like the differences between them are so interesting. But this season, I feel like the most interesting character is the ex-wife, Maura Tierney's character.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
So interesting because you think that she's just like this uptight kind of rich bitch, and she's so much more interesting. She's kind of hippie. There's part of her that doesn't want to have to like hang on to wealth. I love that she like smokes pot on a bench in the park. I never expected that.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
I think that show is just as interesting because you can see her point of view this season.
And she's going to explode. It looks like next episode she's set to explode, which looks great.
We can't wait for.
I think it's a great take on the Rashomon device of storytelling. And I there's something about it. It's sexy. It's dangerous. It's kind of scandalous, but it's still classy. My wife and I, we watch it too, and we're always just like taken back by how steamy it is, and I can't get over some of the sex scenes that they have to do and how close they are together. It's a very intimate show. It's a very, very, and it's a unique show because you're getting the multiple perspectives and you get to say, well, who's telling the truth and how different does this skew from one thing to another? I'm very curious to see where it goes in its second season. And another Showtime show, which I think is really smart and I've been following, is a big show around our house, is Masters of Sex, which I think is just as different and as unique of a show as really as you've gotten in a while. It sort of took the Mad Men sense of period, and also that over, you know, that Dom, that real asshole lead character in Bill Masters, you know, very, very comparable to Don Draper. I think it's a really, really, really great show, and a show that honestly has gotten, for me, it's been as good as it, the last few seasons has been as good as the first. I mean, I'm really enjoying it.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I loved the first season because I felt like it was such a smart bait and switch that it looked like a kind of like late night cable show where there's lots of nudity and it's really sexy. But it just kind of used that to pull you in to be a really interesting show about so many things during that time. And the female characters were so interesting. And I watched the first couple episodes of the current season. I'm behind, but I watched the first two. And I started to feel like, oh, are they really just going to make like two women hook up for the point of it being scandalous? Like it felt slightly cheap to me. Is it getting...
That goes nowhere. But I won't spoil it. But that, they didn't do anything with that.
Okay, good. That's good to hear.
Yeah, which I thought was interesting because that moment, my wife and I looked at each other, were like, really?
Yeah.
Like, okay. I mean, it's the 60s. We're getting more into the, you know, free love experimentation. We're going to get it because, you know, we're going to get into that, I'm assuming, into the next season, you know, because the times are progressing on that show rather rapidly. But no, they don't really go there. So I'd be curious to see what you think of the rest of it. I think that Sheen is incredible, and Lizzie Kaplan is so good.
Oh,
and the stuff with Beau Bridges, his whole subplot is devastating to watch. And
it really is, yeah.
And it's so true because, you know, I didn't live in that time period. I can only assume that subplot is being written with, with a sense of reality to what the situation would have been like for a man like that at that time period. And my God, just how awful it would have been to have been living in the shadows of what you truly would want to say about yourself. And I find the whole thing really just poignant. And Beau Bridges is awesome. Like, you know, for so many years, everyone talks about Jeff, and Beau's always been there and he's always been great. And, you know, here he's getting the chance to shine.
Yeah, and I think what makes that show good is that the difference between your private life and your public life is interesting for all of those characters. Like, I love Libby, Master's wife, I think is so interesting, putting on this face of, like, you know, the doctor's wife and wanting everything to be okay, but then has this, like, really interesting, really different personal life, especially in the past season, that I thought was great. Without spoiling anything.
I haven't watched. I believe I watched the pilot, but I didn't get any further than that. But what I did want to ask you is, I think I'm going to get Stars specifically for Ash versus the Evil Dead.
Yeah.
And I don't. Have you seen that yet?
I have. Yeah, I've seen the first two episodes. I think the second episode is better than the first. I mean, first of all, I know you don't watch a show like that for the acting, but the acting is awesome.
That's great.
The acting is great. Like, there's a guy, this is embarrassing, I can't remember the actor's name, but the guy who plays the sidekick looks like someone drew him out of, like, a graphic novel. Like, he has, like, hair and eyes and facial expressions that make him look like he's, like, a living comic book character.
Cool.
And then, of course, there's just, like, so much over the top stuff that happens. There's a doll that attacks somebody at some point, like an actual, like, child's doll. All sorts of crazy stuff happens. I think if you have to be into, like, the Sam Raimi sense of humor, but if you're into it,
I am too. So essentially what you're saying is we're going to love it.
Yeah, it's definitely a for fans thing. It's not going to broaden their audience, but I think people who love them are going to love it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I'm not a big horror guy, but Sam Raimi's sense of playful mixed with the horror is always something I've responded to. Army of Darkness is a movie I've watched like a zillion times. So, and I've loved Bruce Campbell, and to get a chance to see this world, you know, on a larger scale again will be a lot of fun. Because you said over the top and crazy and violent, I have to bring up Banshee. Banshee is one of the most fucking, excuse the French, insane things that I've ever seen on television. Do you watch the show, or have you seen any of it?
You know, I have. I watched the first few episodes of the first season, and I haven't watched it since then. But I know other TV critics, like Andy Greenwald at Grantland, I know loves that show. And other people whose opinions I respect love it, too. So maybe I should go back to it. I mean, it was over the top from the very beginning for me.
It's over the top, and then it's over the top, and then it reinvents over the top, and you can't. I mean, listen, the show is sex, nudity, violence, repeat. Just the whole thing is just one insane bit of after another of people getting their ass handed to them or just doing crazy shit in the bedroom. It really is a wild show. The central conceit of it is beyond preposterous, and yet they take it seriously and they just run with it. And, Ivana Milosevic, who is one of the leads, she's another actress who I've always loved and just been just a great actress and always in the second or third role. And here she gets to kick a lot of ass in the show. So if you need some ass kicking in your television lineup, look no further than Banshee for sure. I think
Amish people in it.
Yeah, and there's Amish people, and you got the crazy Amish girl. Like, you have the crazy, like, the girl, the Amish girl who's, like, you know, the secret party animal girl and like their whole subplot's awesome. Frank, you'll be you'll be obsessed with Banshee if you watch it.
I will check it out. Speaking of Amish, I did watch the first couple episodes of Breaking Amish when that was on TV, if anybody remembers that show.
I remember it. I never saw it.
No, it was supposed to be a joke, but...
What?
That was supposed to be a joke, and then no one laughed, so... It was terrible, dude. It was just...
Breaking the
anyway.
Ice, wasn't that one of the many reality shows on TLC, or am I just dreaming that up?
We're on MTV or something like
okay.
that.
Okay, all right. Okay.
But I love the documentary that was the reason that got made, the one that's about Rammspringa. I can't remember what it's called, but yeah, I was disappointed that the TV show didn't live up to the documentary.
are you talking about the doc where they show the kid going out on his birthday?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that documentary is amazing. It's called, I can't remember. It's right on the tip of my tongue. It's a really good doc. I can't remember the name. It's really good.
But don't bother with Breaking Amish. Just there's a chick with wooden teeth. I don't know, man. It's weird. So, but on that note, with Breaking Amish and the girl with the wooden teeth, thank you. Thank you so very much for coming on our podcast. This was incredible to be able to chat with you.
Oh, yeah. It's a pleasure. Thanks so much, guys. It got me all excited about now my plan of X-Files watching over Halloween. It was great to talk to you guys.
Please tell us how you like it. That would be – I'll tell you what. If you like it so much that maybe you could come back on our podcast and we can do an X-Files podcast leading up to the revival if you like the show.
That would be great. I would love it. I've got until
awesome.
January, so that's plenty of time, right?
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, thank you again. Everybody check out Melissa at Entertainment Weekly, and we will also link your Twitter feed because I know you live tweet.
I do.
When you watch the television show. So yeah,
Melissa, what is that? I know you're gonna go, but what is live? What is that like to do on a like? So the first time that you watch an episode, you are live tweeting. So do you go back and watch it afterwards and not tweet during it, or?
Yeah, well, usually I'm just watching something. I'm live tweeting something that I don't have to write about if I'm watching it for the first time. But sometimes
gotcha.
I have to live tweet while I'm watching it the first time, and then I have to write about it right afterward within, like, the next hour, get a recap up, which is hard. Personally, I don't know. I feel like live tweeting, I don't know how much people really pay attention to it who aren't journalists, but maybe I'm wrong. Do you watch TV while looking at Twitter?
No.
Yeah. See, I don't really know how much people pay attention to it. And, you know, I love this show called The Returned. It's this French show that's on Sundance Channel. And I love that it's subtitled solely for the reason that I can't look at Twitter when I'm watching it.
It forces you to put that phone down.
Do it well. People do it well. It's really good.
This is a very entertaining, very fast hour, Melissa. So thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedule to talk to the two of us. And yeah, like Frank said, anytime you want to chat TV or anything with us, we'd love to get you back on. And certainly the X-Files, I think you'll enjoy that.
Great. It's so good to talk to you guys. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you again. This was fantastic.